Welcome to Managing Uncertainty, a podcast series from the experts at BrightPath discussing global risk, business continuity, and crisis management. Will you be ready to lead your organization through its critical moment?
Hello and welcome to the Managing Uncertainty podcast. This is Brian Strauser, Principal and CEO at BrightPath. Joining me today are...
Hi, this is Jen Otremba, Consultant BrightPath.
Hi, I'm Bray Wheeler, Consultant at BrightPath.
So this is our long-form episode for the week, and we're going to be diving into, I think, just a roundtable discussion about crisis leadership since the three of us are here. A few weeks back, I had done a solo episode on our podcast about characteristics of strong crisis leaders. We'll link that in the show notes. But I think we want to talk just more openly and with a couple different opinions about what we see as strong and not strong crisis leaders and some of the things we've learned along the way. I think between the three of us, we've got a good 30 plus years of experience in crisis management, and we may have learned a few things along the way.
One or two things
along the way. So what makes a good crisis leader? We start there.
I think it's a lot of things. I think some of it comes a little bit more naturally to people. Some of it's learned, I think, for folks. But I think some of the key things are really having that ability to kind of see the incident for what it is and not overreact to it, not get too flustered by it, kind of see it as an opportunity to kind of jump in and manage the situation for what it is and make sure that you're trying to do the right things and make sure that you're bringing the other people along with you, because it's not a solo sport by any means.
That's a good point. It's not a solo sport at all. So I think it's developing that team around you to work through a situation. It's being careful not to get too emotionally involved with what's going on. I think, like you said, it's really keeping a level head as you're managing through the situation. And then I think also recognizing when you're beginning to escalate, or the people around you are beginning to escalate and get stressed, and separate yourself or separate others as necessary. So it's really being able to read the room and understand kind of where everybody's at.
That self-awareness is a huge piece of it. To your point, I think it's being able to read the room, being able to read yourself, knowing when you're tired, knowing when you're stressed, knowing when you need a break, knowing when somebody else needs one too, to be able to take those intentional pauses. And because that's how you're going to be able to get through that stuff, is to be able to recognize when.
Especially a long-term ongoing situation, right?
I kind of start with just the thought about the person of the crisis leader. And I think you both kind of hinted at this, and I'm just going to go back to the kind of elements of meta leadership that the Harvard National Preparedness Leadership Institute folks have researched and talked about. And that's that crisis leadership starts with the person of the leader. It starts with that understanding of your strengths and weaknesses, or opportunities, as we like to use to say. But what do you do well? And then how do you build a team around you to compensate for the things that you don't do well? Like, I'm well aware I'm not the most empathetic person in the world, but I could build a team around me to do those things, to add that to the toolbox in a crisis. But I think it's understanding kind of what are the things that you do and don't understand. I think the second is just the situational leadership aspect that comes with being the leader of the crisis, that somebody's got to have their head above the clouds, looking around and understanding kind of where you're at and what you know and what you don't know. And what you don't know, to quote Donald Rumsfeld, and understanding how you need to fill those gaps to really understand the impact of what's going on. It's that need to be able to see the big picture.
It's easy to go down a rabbit hole really fast
really
on a crisis.
Fast.
Right.
A crisis.
I mean, look at, we always use the example of Japan with the 2011 tsunami.
Oh my gosh,
earthquake, nuclear issue, where Japan was really, really good at all of those things taken as individual crisis situations. Give them all three at the same time on a scale that the world had never seen, and they didn't see it. They didn't see the issue for what it was, and it cost them. Mm-hmm. And it practically brought the government down. From there, I think it's the leadership aspect of the leader understanding that they've got a couple constituencies that they have to communicate and work with. And that's, they got to be able to lead and communicate up in within their organization. Or if they are the top person in the organization, then now they're interfacing with executives or political leaders, elected leaders who look to you to know the subject matter, but they're dealing with all of these other things. And you've got to, how do you communicate the right message? There's leading the silo, leading the team through the crisis, and then the ability to lead across. And I think that's the most important. It's the connectivity of effort, leading across multiple silos. And some people just don't see that.
I think it even comes before that with the, you had mentioned earlier about developing the team and picking the right team around you. And I think training the team as well so that they're prepared to respond to incidents. And it's not shooting at the hip for every situation.
Mm-hmm.
I also found it interesting that you pointed out that you were not the empathy in the room.
Oh, hell no.
Which we're not either, Bray. So who plays the empathy here?
Marie.
Marie.
I not can really. Be empathetic.
Okay. Not really.
Can you?
Yeah, if
I can
you've
try.
Ever, if you've ever taken. But you know what? I knew this because our previous employer put me in a situation to take an assessment tool, the Herman Brain Dominance Instrument. And it told me I didn't have any empathy. I mean, I literally have no empathy on that scale. But it was interesting to me as a leader to see that. And this was long before I worked in crisis management. But to look at that and go, well, I'm going to have to find some ways to compensate for that. I'm going to have some people around me that have this.
Yeah, I think it's huge to know yourself. You know how you may not know how you're going to react in a crisis situation. We see this all the time, especially in the military. You don't know how you're going to react in those overly stressful situations that are unheard of to the normal population, but you may know yourself to know at least those types of things. Mm-hmm. You're not the person to go to for that, but you know the people on your team that are.
Well, I think it's one of those things too where, you know, I don't think that you're not, you know, Brian, to your point, I don't think that you're not an empathetic person, but it's probably not your natural inclination to go.
No, you're
there.
Right. And I think have to think about it.
And that's those traits in a crisis leader that they need to be aware of. I am that person, and I could be that person outside of work or outside of the situation, but my natural instinct isn't to go there. It's to go here, which isn't wrong, but to know those things and know those things about you, to your guys' point, is to build mm-hmm. that team around you where they go there. And then that kind of
that helps me get there.
Support.
Yeah. That, I mean, I had to your point, I had to train myself that when things happen, that my first questions were, what is the impact on the team? And how are we doing? How is the team doing?
Yeah.
And that team question is twofold. How are the folks at the site or sites that are impacted? Like, how are they doing? But, and I think both of you have brought this up, it's also how the crisis team was doing, right? My team and the other folks that came there to work on the crisis, how are they doing? Because you get into 4 or 5 days of 16-hour a day, 24-hour a day response, and you're dealing with, you've got employees that have been killed or injured and families impacted, homes lost.
Or you, a lot you don't even on. Know where everyone's at.
Right.
And yeah.
I think of like the Boston shooter situation.
Right.
Of trying to account for people and trying to get creative on how we could find out who was where. And that lasted for days.
Mm-hmm.
That was stressful for everyone.
Almost a week. Although really only about a 48-hour period that was crazy.
And I think back to your point, kind of that crisis leader kind of sitting in the middle of all those different tiers, the across, the up, the down, it's their disposition that probably matters most, especially in the probably first 24 to 48 hours of they set the tone. Disposition of how they react, how they're kind of constructing, how they're seeing the scope of the incident matters to how people are reacting to it. Because if you're frazzled, you're overcharged, certainly the people underneath you are going to act that way. The people next to you are going to maybe be asking questions. And the people above you are going to be asking questions too of, are you the right person? Or do I need to be doing more? Or is this a bigger deal? Or it's not that big of a deal. You're overreacting. And so I think it's, to your earlier point, Jen, that level-headedness, that disposition, that mm-hmm. kind of calm in the storm.
I mean, yeah, you can't be otherwise. You have got to find. I mean, first of all, this isn't for everybody.
No,
but it's you have got. Yeah. But there is some ability here to kind of train somebody to do some of this. But you've got to. You have to portray a calm, in control persona, even if it's not even if you're not at the time. I mean, you might have 1,000 things going on in your head. Mm-hmm. You better be talking about one.
Yeah.
Right.
I think, and some of the things that we've done in the past and our different experiences is we had teams that were large enough to where we didn't have to be that direct mm-hmm. leader each time.
Right.
We could take turns as to who, okay, you got this one. All right. Then I will step back and play the other role of taking care of everyone while you're managing through that. So I think for us, we were lucky enough in a lot of different situations that we've worked in to where we had other leaders that we could lean on to, you know, this time isn't my turn. This time is my turn to be the follower. So I think being a good leader is a big part of that is also being a good follower when it's not your turn to mm-hmm. be the leader.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine was the police incident commander during the 35W bridge collapse here in Minneapolis back in 2007.
Yeah.
It was 2007, mm-hmm. right? I was not in crisis management at the time. I was on my little hiatus doing other things within corporate security at our previous employer. But he was the fire department and the sheriff's department had incident command because this was on the river. But they, you know, it was the Minneapolis police were a significant part of the response. They had hundreds of people down there. And they get their command post set up in the Red Cross parking lot there overlooking the Mississippi. And they had trained this particular lieutenant for a couple of years to be like one of the top. He was going to be the next guy to run this kind of stuff when my friend retired. They had a couple incidents where he had kind of been frazzled and had kind of yelled and snapped at some people, but apparently just went off on somebody a couple hours into the response. And my friend relieved him and sent him home. And that was the end of his time in, you know, kind of large scale incident management in the public sector. Went on to a great law enforcement career. I don't want to impugn the guy's reputation, but this was not for him. They did not have the mindset to do this because you can't act like that. You've got to be calm and controlled and in control of the situation.
Well, yeah. It doesn't make you a bad person or a bad professional. It's almost a calling. You have to naturally kind of be inclined to put yourself in those situations, want to be put in those situations. Know yourself well enough to know that that is what you're going to do. You're going to kind of go into the fire, so to speak.
I think sometimes it can be important to acknowledge, too, that while you may portray good traits as a good crisis leader one day, another day you may have a lot of personal things going mm-hmm. on or your mind isn't there and that's not your day. So even though today may not be the best day for you when the 35W bridge collapsed, they may be a great leader in another situation mm-hmm. when their mind was in a different place.
Or they're more comfortable with yep. that kind of an incident.
Exactly.
You know,
that's true.
Put me in a cyber incident, I'm probably not as calm as, you know, natural disaster or something else. But right. I think it's that comfortability factor, too, I think is huge, too. But it's also, to your point, having a bad day. Yeah. You got to be able to recognize I'm having a bad day.
You really
it's
do.
It's and not then my day. Or I have to know enough to set that aside if I'm the only one that's on docket. So. Yeah.
I think you may also have to recognize as maybe a secondary leader that your primary leader isn't having a bad day. And they may have to be removed, like you said, Brian. Mm-hmm. And as a good leader, you have to recognize somebody's telling you that, it's probably true. So step down and move aside and let somebody else take over, at least for a while.
And certainly, I mean, lots of responses are a 24/7 thing. Your own fatigue is a big issue. The fatigue of your team, I think, to your point about rotating and shifting people in and out, it's necessary. I mean, I remember when I first got into crisis management full time in 2005, come around Labor Day, Hurricane Katrina hits, followed by Hurricane Wilma. And Hurricane Rita. I put this out of order. Hurricane Rita and then Hurricane Wilma. And I don't think I had a day off for 60 days, 58, 59 days. Because we didn't have, at the time, we didn't have the resources and we didn't have the structure that we would have later on mm-hmm. when we built those capabilities out. That was not a healthy environment for the four or five of us that were carrying the load for this. But we didn't have anything else. That was it.
Well, I think of, to your point there, working in consulting, I've learned a lot about working with smaller organizations that don't have built out teams quite like we did. And we've had a lot of different organizations reach out to us for specific needs. You know, maybe it's just to understand or be better at crisis communications in that moment because you don't have that expertise. And I think there's no shame in asking for help outside of your organization as well, mm-hmm. whether that be with a consultant or mm-hmm. even just people you know.
Well, I think it gets back to one of the mantras we used to when you need a friend.
It's too late to make one.
Yeah,
that's not just external partners in law enforcement or EMS. It's the internal partners. It's having those teams. It's having that buy-in. It's having those relationships in place that if you are a 1-2 person crisis management shop, you need those other players in the organization to know that, yeah, my other hat is crisis. So when mm-hmm. something happens, I am shifting into that. I am helping there. Mm-hmm. And the organization knows that too. It's not just that HR person wanting to. HR knows that that's, yep, something happened. I'm shifting into that because that's what the company needs. Or that's what the organization needs.
Well, I think the partnership thing is, if you think about partnerships with other organizations, I think it's important to look at, there's a two-way street there that develops over time in that relationship or that partnership. It's not just about transactional nature of needing something in a crisis. I remember there were tornadoes that came through Minneapolis. Gosh, I don't remember when, 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. They went into North Minneapolis, caused a lot of damage, right?
Yes.
Remember this? That was a big deal. So I was an impact. Our company, I was in charge of crisis management at the time for a Fortune 50 company. We were not impacted. But on my own accord, I picked up the phone and called Minneapolis's deputy chief of police and said, hey, and it was like 8 o'clock at night, I think, when this thing happened. I'm like, hey, chief, just call in to see if you need anything. Do you need something? And he goes, hold on. He was in the command center. So he may want anything. But, you know, they were okay. They had a great response. Fast forward to 2012. We had a active shooter situation that we were all three involved in that was across the street from our offices. And for 3 or 4 hours, we didn't really know what was really going on. And it turned out to be a construction noise. That occurred. This guy at this point is retired from Minneapolis PD, calls me just to see, one, do you need anything? Two, do you want to talk? And this was that night. Do you want to talk about kind of what went down that day? Knowing that like we thought people were in harm's way and you know, it turned out to be a false alarm, but we were all concerned about that. That's the kind of partnership I think you develop mm-hmm. over time. It's not just about big company helping big police department and vice versa.
It's that community piece of it too. Mm-hmm. Just that communal, not only broad scale, but just that crisis community mm-hmm. of people who are in that kind of in the weeds all the time.
I do. And then I want to shift and talk about how do you kind of train or get educated on some of this. But during the 2017 hurricane season, which was such a monumental event for 4 months, between Harvey and Irma and Maria, I was at Bright Path, but we were supporting, I was serving as interim chief security officer for a university mm-hmm. that was impacted in all three of those. And it was a pretty stressful time because they didn't have the resources that we had had previously. We've since, you know, they built some things after this, but I went to the Harvard MPLI program and I got an email in the middle of the hurricane season from Dr. Lenny Marcus, the co-director of the program, who said, hey, I'm down here with the Red Cross today in Virginia, but I've been all over talking to people, and I see a lot of you as alumni making huge impact, but here's some things to remember, and kind of took us back to the things we would talk about in the program. And I thought that was such a meaningful email to send, knowing that, God, he probably had 200, 250 alumni on the ground, in leadership roles, doing different things, private sector, public sector. That connectivity, I think, really helps as you think about how you're dealing with and working through these situations. So how do you learn this beyond doing it?
Practice, unfortunately. real life experience.
Yeah, you don't really know how you're going to react. I know I said this before, but nobody knows how they're going to react in a situation, unfortunately, until you're put into the situation. I think if you want to get into this line of work, the best place you could be is in an organization that has multiple crisis leaders that you can learn from. Being thrown into it where you're the only one and you've never done it before, I don't think is the best place for you. That's not what I would recommend. I think it would be best to be somewhere where you can learn from other people, see different styles so that you can develop your own style, mm-hmm. and experience those things where you're not the only point person. There's yeah. obviously school programs you can mm-hmm. go to. The academia has all kinds of options out there, but that's not going to be how you learn how to actually be in the nitty gritty.
Right.
You're going to learn some basics there, but...
Well, yeah, some of the structure and fundamentals and the background
and
the context of all of it. But it, to your point, it is one of those things where you have to put yourself in situations where you experience it, whether it's you're just kind of one of the minions, you know, helping execute it, or you're a partner, or you have some sort of an assistant role or something like that. But you almost have to be in it and watch it, observe it. I know from my early days, I was brand new into the concept and hired in, but you know, it wasn't until the wildfires in California, 08, that it was really like, okay, now my feet have been wet for a little bit for, you know, 9 months or something like that. But now I understand what's going on. Now I see what's happening. And that was really eye-opening for me to be able to step into that and get a taste for this is full on, and watching it play out and being able to jump in and kind of my instincts kicking in to kind of know what to do, what to expect.
Yeah. One benefit too, I think, for me having a pretty long career military wise is we in the military like to train, overtrain, exercise, train, exercise, train. And there's something to be said. I mean, when we do it, man, it is awful, but there's something to be said about having so much training behind you so that when you're in a situation, you at least have an idea, a little bit of an idea about how you can react and have some of the automatics happen right away, because you don't have to go back and read again a protocol because you have memorized what am I going to do in this situation. And you work together with other members of your military unit as well, so that when you're in those situations together, you've worked together. In the civilian sector, we do the same thing where we run exercise after exercise after exercise. We don't do it as often, I think, in the civilian sector as we do in the military, but doing those over and over help to develop those sort of skills and those checklists in your mind as well.
Especially if your organization is brand new, or the people in that kind of comprise your team, however big, however small, if they're new to it as well, it's the more you do it, the better relationship you have with each other, which makes whatever response you end up doing easier. Because otherwise everybody's flying blind, or everybody's inexperienced, or nobody knows. And then it becomes, you're complicating it for yourself. You're throwing up other obstacles in your way because nobody has that experience, or nobody knows how to interact with each other.
I mean, I think it's fair to say, I mean, everyone's got their own learning style,
yes.
and we should accommodate that as we think about this. I don't think there's any substitute for experiencing this in real life in an organization where there's people senior to you that can teach you and mentor you and kind of bring you through this. That's how all three of us kind of learned mm-hmm. this, at least when we started. Mm-hmm. I think exercises are great if they're realistic. And we do exercises as a company for clients, and we've gone to the very realistic stage, I think, at this point in our consulting careers, where we want it to be under pressure. We want people to feel time constrained. We want them to have to make the tough decisions, and where there's limited time and information and you got to decide what you're going to do. I also think there's a place for the academic aspect of this, which is there are programs you can go to and learn this. I'm biased. I think the Harvard MPLI program, because it is focused on leadership versus like, how do you structure an exercise? None of that happens there. There's none of the nuts and bolts. This program is about how do you lead in a crisis? And when you're talking about, there's a lot of discussion of cases where, that I think is even beyond what I saw in business school on my MBA, where in an MBA program, you read a case and then you discuss the case and you might take action on the case in terms of talking through or writing something. But at NPLI, when you talk about a case, you bring the principal that was involved in the case to the class and they tell the story and you talk to them about what happened. And I think there's no substitute for that kind of experience in terms of learning about what happened, right? So when we talked about managing an organization through a reputational challenge, we had the director of the Secret Service, the incumbent director of the Secret Service, come in, off the record conversation, no press contact, no sharing, and he walked us through what happened in their scandal in Cartagena, where they had agents that were hiring prostitutes and other things that went on down there, and military personnel and others, and they got caught. So he's the Secret Service director. How does he manage through that? Okay, so that I thought was a great example of crisis leadership, and I agreed with many of the things that he talked about doing, right or wrong, about how they dealt with this. But I think programs like that are great. Mm-hmm. There's other good programs in crisis management and business continuity, but they're not focused on leadership. And I think what I got out of Harvard was about here's how you should think as a leader dealing with these situations, and what are the things you should look for in yourself, good or bad, and how to compensate for that, you know, as you're building the team around you.
Yeah, I think to build onto that, it's that self-assessment piece is critical too, to know yourself. And we talked about this earlier, but just it is important to know those things and to know where your limits are. I think the other piece too is there's a lot of good examples of companies that have gone through different situations, whether it's reputational, whether it's right or wrong or tragic or not, you know, finding those stories, finding those breakdowns, finding those reports from Harvard, from other places where they've deep dived into it and they're talking to people and reading those articles or those papers or books, you know, to at least get a sense of how did they respond? What were they thinking about? What did they learn? What, you know, at the very minimum, I mean, it's that preparation. It's that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. I love that actually, because we spend a lot of time talking about at Bright Path, especially, we talk about a lot of things that go wrong and how they manage. And we break it down to, well, mm-hmm. how did they manage through it? What did they do? What could they have done better? So I think to your point, that sort of, even if it's your own incident, making sure that you're running through that after action with your team so that mm-hmm. you can get better for the next time. I think that says a lot about a leader when you're able to not only assess yourself, but have your team assess you.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen this. We've seen good and bad leaders in our experience from a crisis standpoint.
Yeah.
We've seen incredibly intelligent folks who are great leaders within their organization could not lead through a basic crisis situation because of a number of different reasons. It could be they have low kind of emotional intelligence, and so they panic and they get frustrated. We've seen the let's debate the decision for 4 hours situation. Meanwhile, you got people in harm's way, wait, looking to you to make a call. There's a lot of different things that I think we've seen, but what we've run through, I think, is a pretty good example of here's what a good crisis leader looks like. Here's what good crisis leadership looks like. Here's some ways to grow it within the org. Closing thoughts, Bray?
I would say one thing that we kind of talked about off air too is I think it's important to remember that this isn't an opportunity for promotion. It's not an opportunity that a crisis leader should look to take advantage of. It's an opportunity that needs to happen for the company. You need to step in that role with some clarity, and it's not about you at that point, no matter kind of what's going on. And if it does involve you or it is part of you, you know, it is you, you should probably step aside, you know, because there is that bias coming into play. But it really isn't about you at that point. It's about the organization. It's about the people impacted.
It's about
the
team.
That's where your head's got to be at.
There's my lack of empathy speaking. It's about the team.
Jen?
I don't think I could put it any better than that, honestly. I completely agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've hit everything that was on my mind. I just end with this, that if you're the crisis leader in the critical moment, your team and your organization is looking for you to lead them. Lead them.
Yep.
Take them through the situation.
Be the leader.
Be the leader. And if you're not the right person, find somebody that can and bring them in and put them under you and let them lead it.
I would say too, so my final thought.
It turns out Bray has a lot to say.
I have a lot to say on the subject. No, I think it's to your point, if you're the designated crisis leader, that's, like we said, that's your opportunity to kind of step into that and lead them. That's why you're in that role. But I think if you're not in that role, if you're one of the key partners, you're on the their cross-functional team. If you're underneath that person, you're still a crisis leader. You still have a job to do. You still have to lead your respective area. You still have to be that player. So it's also about being a kind of a crisis follower too, where you're in it and you're self-aware enough to know, I'm tired, I got to take a step back, or I know about this, let me see what I can do to help. I think there's that designated crisis leader, but everybody else has got to have a little bit of that too, to be able to get through it.
Right. There's some responsibility for everyone on the team, but yeah, be the leader or be the follower, right?
Cause it's the culture of the team is what probably makes or breaks that response.
Mm-hmm. That's it for this edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast. Join us next week with our update on current events and news from around the world. Hope to see you then.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Managing Uncertainty, produced by the experts at BrightPath. To receive notifications of new episodes, join our newsletter at brightpath.com or subscribe through your favorite podcast player, such as iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about the services and trusted advice from BrightPath by visiting brightpath.com. That's BrightPath.com.